Shrink Wrap Radio number 492, Exploring Adolescent Depression, with Patrick Kelly, MD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Patrick Kelly, MD, is a Johns Hopkins-trained psychiatrist, faculty member at the UCLA Medical School, and co-author of the second edition of Adolescent Depression, A Guide for Parents. For more information about Dr. Kelly, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Eyeglasses cost too much. Now you can save by ordering online from Warby Parker. More about this special offer later in our podcast. Before we go to the interview, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is putting on a year-long online certification course in West African divination and counseling with Maladoma Somme, whom I interviewed on episode number 444. For information and sign up, go to jungplatform.com/courses. Dr. Patrick Kelly, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you on the show, and we're going to be talking about the book that you co-authored, and it's titled Adolescent Depression, A Guide for Parents. Mm-hmm. But before we go into that, maybe you can tell us something about your own background and how you came to specialize in adolescent depression.
Sure, absolutely. So I did most of my training in psychiatry in Baltimore at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. I did 3 years of adult psychiatry there. Then I did what's called fast tracking into child and adolescent psychiatry. I knew that was my interest pretty much from the get-go. And then during that time frame, I got very interested in the mood disorders of children and adolescents, because we see very clear, sometimes not so clear, but usually very clear patterns in adults in what this looks like. You know, the repeated cyclical episodes of depression, of mania, but in children and adolescents, no one seemed to know exactly what that looked like, and there was a lot of confusion about it. And some people way overdiagnosed, some people way underdiagnosed, so I thought it would be a good chance to learn more about the issues and to help some kids.
Yeah, it sounds like you had some sense that you wanted to go that direction early on, and it makes me, if it's not too personal, were you depressed as an adolescent yourself?
No, that's a perfectly acceptable answer. I don't know if I was depressed with the big D depression, but I, like a lot of adolescents, I think, went through up times and down times, and I questioned that, you know, am sure. I depressed? Am I going to feel better? Is this going to pass? Mm-hmm. And in my case, I was lucky it did. You know, for some adolescents go through their whole lives like that, and it's a terrible way to feel.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the main focus of your book is as a guide for parents. However, for the purposes of this interview, rather than focusing on that part of it so much, I'm more interested in the phenomenon of adolescent depression and what we know and what we don't know about it. So my questions will be slanted a bit more that way, okay?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. So the first one you've already kind of touched on, which is, are the symptoms of adolescent depression different at all from those of adult depression?
I would say that they are. For some adolescents, you do see the very classic social withdrawal, inability to sleep, depressed, down mood, thoughts of suicide. But for some adolescents, you see much more agitation, aggression. Kids who live on a sort of a hair trigger, who are always seemingly ready to explode at the slightest provocation. And, you know, again, there's some overlap. You do see that in adults sometimes, but it's much, much more common to see that in children and adolescents. Plus, like I've touched on a little bit, children and adolescents are defined almost by periods of transition. They're not in a stable state. There are so many stages of change that happen in child and adolescent development that it is somewhat normative for them to have more emotional highs and lows, I would say, than most adults have. So what's sure. normal and what's not normal is harder to tease apart.
And I would think that would make the diagnosis difficult, that since it sounds like it can manifest in a variety of ways.
It does. That's what I find interesting, right? I like the difficult stuff.
Oh, okay. Good for
but
you.
No, it absolutely does. I always joke with especially the general psychiatry residents who start a child and adolescent psychiatric fellowship that they're going to have to spend a lot more time figuring out what's going on with their children and adolescents than they did with their adults. First of all, because children and adolescents are much poorer. They don't have the language to describe their internal experience that adults have. Some children and adolescents suffer from alexithymia. They don't even know how they're feeling inside. Plus, you have to talk to teachers, parents. You have to get a larger amount of collateral history than you do with an adult patient. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot longer, and it is much more complicated to tease apart, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. How prevalent is adolescent depression? I don't know if you've got the stats at the top of your mind, but if you do, fine, and if you don't, just give us your sense of it.
Sure. So I have the ones that are in my head, which I think are still accurate. But in very young children, it's fairly rare, but is recognizable. In even young kids, school-age kids, about, 0.5 to 1%. Then in adolescents, it gets significantly higher, about 5%. And one thing I find very interesting is that the gender ratio changes once you reach adolescence. So in young children, the gender ratio is approximately 1 to 1. But then depending on the data that you look at, once you get into adolescence, once you pass puberty, the gender ratio changes to 1 to 2 to 1 to 4, males to females. So adolescent women are much more likely to manifest depression after they enter puberty than men. Although for both men and women, it's very tied to hormones and to hormonal cycles. And the gender ratio actually returns to 1 to 1 past menopause. But I find it very interesting that biological depression is so biological. You can even see it in the hormonal changes. It's so intimately tied together.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you your guess about what was going on there, but you explained it. And I guess I already asked you how depression manifests itself in adolescence. Is there anything more that you want to say about that?
I think when we talk to parents, the most important things to look at in their children is severity and persistence. So in differentiating normal depression or normal life changes from a real biological depression that they need to be worried about. So if a mild depression that you think is normal starts but persists for months or even longer than that, then maybe it's time to look a little bit deeper into what's going on. And similarly, if a kid just falls off a cliff, if they're going along just fine in their life and one day they wake up severely irritable, seemingly just completely down in the dumps, can't even get out of bed. So either the severity or the persistence are real cues that we look at in children and adolescents for something that we'd be more worried about.
Okay. And what's the age range that we're talking about when we say adolescence?
So generally it's 12 to 18. So child and adolescent psychiatrists typically divide the sort of 0 to 18 into three age groups. There's depending on who you ask, 0 to 5 or 0 to 6. Then there's about 6 to 12, the school age group. And then there's the adolescent group, 12 to 18. There's a lot of research that's going into the sort of 16 to 24-year-olds now, the TAE group, transitional age youth, because we used to think, I don't know where this came from, but we used to think right at 18 you go immediately from childhood to adulthood. Which is simply not true. There's a large transitional period that we're recognizing more and more in these young people.
Yeah, I think my adolescence lasted well into my 50s, quite frankly. And something I found interesting is that you distinguish between the symptoms of depression and the syndrome of depression. Mm-hmm. What's the difference there?
So the symptoms are what we can see and evaluate from the outside. It's if somebody says that they're feeling more fatigued, if they lose their appetite, if they're, you know, for older adolescents, if they're not as interested in relationships, if they're socially isolated, if they feel more sad. So each of those are sort of discrete symptoms. If you put all of that together and look at what might be causing that, you find the syndrome of depression. What's changed inside the body, inside the mind, inside the psychology that's causing those symptoms to manifest? Mm-hmm. The reason we distinguish that is we've had experiences where very well-meaning parents, teachers will send a child in because they sort of flippantly said, you know, gosh, I wonder what it would be like if I weren't alive anymore, which is never flippant. I don't mean to say that. Or they, you know, have mild trouble sleeping. They pick an individual symptom to pay attention to and sort of assume that the syndrome of depression is behind that and what's causing it, which is not necessarily true. So we try to say that the symptoms are signs. They're things that we can look at. But they're not equivalent to the depression, that those can be different things. Also, depression can lay quiescent in a number of adolescents or adults. Just because somebody is feeling good at the moment doesn't mean they don't have the underlying syndrome of depression that can pop up at any time. The average length of a major depressive episode is 7 to 9 months, which is a long period of time. But we know from research, even untreated persons with depression will surface from it. That doesn't mean they don't need ongoing treatment, ongoing medication, ongoing psychotherapy, and that they're sort of cured or that it's gone. It's still there. They're just not having symptoms at the moment.
Okay. And you say that depression is a mood disorder and that it's a real illness.
Right.
And so that was kind of intriguing. What do you mean by a real illness?
Well, we're getting closer to figuring out exactly what's behind depression, but the more we learn about it, the more it does seem to be genetically inherited. It seems to be responsive to medications. It does seem to be something that we can focus on and treat that has genetic causes that we're getting closer and closer to finding. So we did notice that, and I think you would say this as well, that there's, at least in the medical community, something of a stigma against mental health, that
yep.
it's not the same as diabetes, that it's not the same as myocardial infarction, that it's somehow different. And just like seizures back in the day, you know, fits. People used to call them fits, and they used to be managed by psychiatrists. People were taken by the spirit. Now that we have the ability to look closely enough and look in the right way, we can see exactly what's happening to the brain in the midst of a seizure and see the biological underpinnings. And we think that we're getting closer and closer to doing that with depression, major depression. We're just not there yet. So we want to say that these are just as valid and just as, frankly, dangerous as any other medical condition, and that dismissing them as something other than that could be a mistake.
Yeah, I seem to recall reading that that if depression, and I don't know if I'm thinking of the wrong syndrome or not, but I think it was that if depression went untreated, that there were changes in the brain that could become more or less permanent.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. So there are a number of different changes. There are changes called epigenetic changes, which means that things happen to the DNA, DNA methylation, that actually change the genetic expression of the individual, even though you may not necessarily pass that on to your offspring. So we know that that can happen for people who are depressed for long periods of time. We know that that can happen for people who suffer from PTSD, who maybe never had a major depressive episode, but
yes,
have such a severe impact that it changes their brain. And actually, we've seen the reverse. We've done fMRI studies where we look at people's brains as they're recovering from depression, and parts of the brain actually grow. The hippocampus regenerates, which we used to think was impossible, that the central nervous system can't heal itself. But we're finding that people do recover from depression in a very recognizable visual way.
Yeah, that is exciting. Now, as you indicated earlier, adolescence is a time of a certain amount of moodiness.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you determine that it's serious enough to call it a depression?
That's a great question, and that's the thing that we struggle with the most, even as psychiatric professionals, making that determination. You know, we certainly look at what might be traveling in the family. So if there's a family history, we're much more likely to be on the lookout for a real major depression. Again, it's persistence and severity are two of the aspects that we look very closely at. We do see if this is a significant change from someone's underlying personality, someone who used to be exuberant and excited, used to take on every new challenge, used to attack things, just all of a sudden turns into a very shy, introverted, reluctant person. And people are allowed to change. I'm not saying that, but if it is a big drastic change from who they used to be, we worry about that more. We spend a lot of time doing this, I think, is the only way to say it. The psychiatry doesn't have an x-ray or a blood test to tell exactly what's going on. So it's about looking at the symptoms, trying to determine the pattern of the symptoms and see if it indicates an underlying syndrome of depression or if it's just a normal change. We would caution everybody, though, that trying to do this on your own is incredibly difficult. Even psychiatrists would tell you that you can't treat yourself. You can't see yourself. Psychiatrists and psychotherapists, right? So parents and children trying to sort of work through this problem on their own, it's very, very difficult to figure out. So we would always recommend anyone who's concerned to try to get a referral to a trusted counselor, a trusted psychotherapist, a trusted psychiatrist, someone to help them make that determination if they are worried about it.
Yeah, and I would think that one of the things that you probably look at routinely is there a precipitating event, such as the loss of a relationship, the death of a relative, something like that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there is normal bereavement. You know, there's normal sadness that follows those sorts of life events. But if someone has more severe symptoms, you know, we've had young persons who lose a trusted grandfather who unfortunately lose their parent, and they say, I woke up in the middle of the night and I saw my mom standing in my doorway. You know, am I hallucinating? Am I going crazy? No, that's very normal. That's a very normal response. But if they see that person constantly, if they hear that voice all the time, if they want to die themselves to be with that person, or because life is not worth living without them, then we would be much more worried about that precipitating a real depression as opposed to just being sort of a normal adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I would think the prevalence of drug use would complicate diagnosis even more, right?
Absolutely. Yep, that's very, very true. Uh-huh. So you can't. It's very difficult to see through drug use to see what's behind it. You can go back in the pattern to what somebody was feeling like before they started using drugs, because some people do self-treat with alcohol or with other substances to try to lift their mood, to try to alleviate a low mood.
Yeah.
Even though we know in the long term most of those chemicals are depressants and are more likely to make you depressed, they feel good in the moment and they can relieve stress. But if you have somebody who's intoxicated or who's really in the throes of a major substance abuse problem, we usually don't independently treat depression unless we're very convinced of it. We try to clean all that up first and see what's lying underneath. Because withdrawal, we know that withdrawal from substances like cocaine, methamphetamines, can look in the moment, in the cross-section, just like a major depressive episode. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to distinguish them.
Wow. Speaking of distinguishing and diagnostic issues, you distinguish between a number of mood disorders in adolescence, including major depressive disorder, which you've been talking about, dysthymic disorder, which I thought was an old term. I wasn't sure that was in use anymore. Premenstrual dysphoric disorder, mm-hmm. bipolar disorder, disruptive mood dysregulation, dysregulation disorder.
Yep.
Can you give us a sense of what some of the differences are between these?
Sure, of course. No, that's a great question. So the DSM-5, the update to the DSM tried to clean up a lot. They added premenstrual dysphoric disorder. They added disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. They did change somewhat the definition of dysthymic disorder, but they all are different beasts, although in the moment, the depressive symptoms themselves, again, getting back to symptoms and syndromes, can look very similar. So major depressive disorder to us is it's deeper than just sort of the symptoms of feeling sad for 2 weeks or,
right.
You know, feeling suicidal. It's a repeated pattern of these major depressive episodes where the ground just falls out from under your mood and your mood seems to have a mind of its own. Dysthymia is more of a chronic low-grade simmering depression that persists over time, and people can surface from it. People can have normal moods throughout, but they do last for months to years. Some kids will say, I've never felt happy. I don't remember feeling happy. I don't know what that feels like. And then you get them in treatment, and they say, oh, this is how everyone feels all the time. This is
wow.
Lovely.
That must be very gratifying when that happens.
It's very nice. It's not the most common thing we see, but when it does happen, it makes us all feel very good, including the patient, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Premenstrual dysphoric disorder is an interesting syndrome where about 5 days before a woman begins her menstrual cycle, she enters a true major depressive episode. What's interesting about that is that we can use medications almost on an as-needed basis to try to prevent that. But when they're in that major depressive episode, again, it's indistinguishable from a major depressive disorder. Again, getting back to symptoms and syndromes. Something like bipolar affective disorder, we introduced a whole new chapter on that in the book because it's so complicated to try to figure out in young people. But that classically is defined as both major depressive episodes and either hypomanic or manic episodes, so the flip side of depression, where you have tons of energy all the time. You don't sleep, not because you're sitting there worried about what's going to happen the next day. It's because you're up creating. It's because you don't need to sleep. Sometimes it can get to the point where you think you have superhuman powers or superhuman strengths. I don't want to get into this unless you do, because there's a huge controversy about what mania looks like in kids and how to figure that out. But that's,
yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I'm aware that there's a controversy. Maybe you can kind of outline the key issues there.
Sure.
So without a whole textbook worth.
Right. Cut me off if I get too far.
But, okay.
It used to be that the diagnostic criteria, probably appropriately, for children and adults was exactly the same. If you see a young person and you are going to diagnose them with bipolar disorder, they have to meet all the criteria for mania that an adult would meet. They have to have that elevated mood. They have to have that lack of need for sleep. They have to have that grandiosity. They can have some of that irritability in a mixed episode, but they really have to show that cyclical pattern. It has to be just like you're treating an adult. Then people try to figure out what might bipolar affective disorder look like before you see that first mania. Can we go back in time and see if we can prevent that? What are the kernels of that? And people started focusing more on irritability, the irritable mood that some kids seem to have. Maybe that's what mania looks like before we see it full-blown. What's interesting is that treatments for bipolar affective disorder in the form of antipsychotics, which used to be reserved mostly for the major psychotic illnesses but have some mood stabilizing properties, some very good mood stabilizing properties, used to be used more and more frequently for this quote-unquote bipolar affective disorder in children. And because they are the major tranquilizers, they would slow kids down. But treatment response doesn't mean that they had bipolar disorder to begin with. So just the use of these medicines and the diagnosis of bipolar disorder exploded in children and adolescents. I don't have the data in front of me, but I think it increased by tenfold or more. We're now getting back to trying to analyze exactly what's going on with a child. And in the DSM-5, they've really teased that apart in a very nice way, I think. They've created this disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which does characterize that chronic irritability that a number of children that we see have. And they've put that pretty firmly in the category of depressive disorders, which is useful also because it helps in treatment. It used to be that if someone's diagnosed bipolar disorder, we would never put them on an antidepressant, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, because we'd worried about pushing them into mania. But that left a number of these children who really had either depression or now we know as DMDD, untreated fundamentally, because you're not doing anything to help their low mood. You're leaving them in a state where, sure, you're blocking the mania with something like a neuroleptic, but you're not helping the depressive symptoms. And they've taken that and split that off from true bipolar affective disorder in young persons, which does have to meet pretty much the exact same criteria as adults. So we're in a bit of a resurgence. It's filtering through the community. I think people are recognizing it more and more. I'll be honest, at UCLA, we do a lot of de-diagnosing. We have a lot of young persons and even young adults who come in with the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And with very careful taking of the history, we say that's not what's going on with you. You have control over this. You need psychotherapy. You don't need lithium or Depakote or, mm-hmm. or some big heavy medication like that.
Yeah. Because when you say there was an explosion of seeing something, there's always that issue of is that because, is there a real change in the underlying phenomenon,
right,
or is there a change in the mindset of the diagnosticians that suddenly, they're slicing and dicing in a different way?
Right, that's exactly right. And at the same time, you don't want to miss children who might not be getting the diagnosis, so you do want to be in tune to it, but But, you know, because it's the fad of the moment doesn't mean that every irritable child you see has bipolar disorder.
Yeah. Now, there's been such a wonderful explosion of knowledge about the brain, and you kind of alluded to that a bit earlier. What do we know about depression in terms of the brain?
So we do know more and more. We don't know as much as we would like, frankly. You know, we don't even really know how our medications treat depression. We know that they work. We're getting closer and closer. But in theory, the way some of these medicines work, for example, the SSRIs, you take a pill, the chemical in the pill, it doesn't really change the brain. It just helps your body hold on to more chemicals that your brain's making anyway, serotonin. And slowly over time, the levels of serotonin rise. You would think that if depression was purely serotonin responsive, that increase in the level would cause an alleviation in depression much more quickly than we actually see it. So people say, does it change genetic expression? Maybe that's how it works. Is there a fundamental deficiency in the serotonin receptor allele? That's one of the new theories that we're sort of overcoming. We don't really know how these help. We do know that they help, which is good, and that they don't necessarily have long-term side effects or long-term changes. But we don't know exactly what's going on to cause depression. We're getting closer and closer. Like I've said, we can see the brain shrink and grow with depressive treatment. We know that there's actual neuronal death. One of the ways that lithium, one of the most powerful antidepressive agents, although it's thought as a mood stabilizer, one of the most powerful antidepressant agents that we have, we know that one of its major functions is, in fact, as a neuroprotective agent. It prevents neuronal death and prevents degradation of the neurons. But how exactly does that stabilize mood? How exactly does that prevent depression? We don't really know. So I would say we're still in a state where we know less than we'd like, but we're getting closer and closer to identifying this as a true biological phenomenon for true major depression.
Neuronal death is sort of a startling thing to say. I'm not sure I've heard of that associated with depression. Are the neurons dying, and in what numbers?
Well, it is a strong comment. Maybe neuronal death is a big statement, but you see the brain shrink for people who are chronically depressed for a long period of time, especially in that hippocampal area, the areas of the brain like the amygdala that are tied to emotional response and emotional regulation. You can actually track that. You can see that. A lot of the new neuroimaging studies are focusing on something called cortical thickness. So the way our brain is set up, we have two types of matter that we can see, white matter and gray matter. The white matter are the axons of the nerves, and the gray matter are the actual cell bodies of the nerves. So when you're talking about cortical thickness, you're talking about that outer stripe of gray matter, and that's thinner in areas of the brain compared with normal, quote-unquote normal, persons as opposed to those who are suffering with depression or schizophrenia or other major mental illnesses. So we actually see that, you know, I said neuronal death, maybe failure of neuronal genesis would be a better way to say it, but we see that actually happens. Now, some neuronal death, I don't want to make people terrified that if they feel sad, their brain is shrinking. Some neuronal death is actually normal. There's a process as we grow up called pruning, where neurons that aren't needed are sort of trimmed away to make the brain more efficient. And that's a perfectly normal process, but that can certainly be accelerated. Probably the biggest example we'll see of that for us is substance use. Chronic alcoholics, chronic users of ecstasy, their brain shrinks. You can do a CAT scan, and a 40-year-old chronic alcoholic will have the brain, effectively, that we can see of a 70-year-old, you know, non-alcoholic person. You can see that shrinking happening, and that's not normal.
Yeah, and that's not really been out in the media, the popular media. I don't know that people are aware, you know, that their brain is so clearly impacted as that. That seems like that could be an important public health message, and maybe it will be at some point.
Sure. We're starting it here.
Yes, right now. That's right. Let's talk a bit about issues surrounding medication. Childhood and adolescence are critical times of growth and development, and I would think we would need to be especially careful about intervening in brain systems that might have a long-lasting negative impact. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that's very true. I think you're exactly right, and I think there are two. I have two strong thoughts about that.
Okay, good.
One is in terms of treatment for depression and in terms of treatment with medications like the SSRIs. So like I've just described, people who are going through depression do have thinning of their cortex. We see that as thinner. We know that depression can impair cognition, can cause inattention, can make it more difficult for kids to learn. So in the long term, we know that depression is much more damaging to the brain than the antidepressants, than the SSRIs. We've been able to use those long enough and to follow people for a long enough period of time to know that treated depression, actually, persons with treated depression through the SSRIs have better brains, have higher cognition than those who are chronically depressed. So of course, parents are worried about introducing any sort of foreign chemical into their child, especially during a period of growth. But treating an underlying mental illness, if you really think it's there, can be much more helpful than any of these chemicals can be harmful. Now, there is a flip side to that. The flip side gets down to the rampant diagnosis of bipolar disorder that I spoke about. So we also know that over the long term, some of the neuroleptics, some of the antipsychotic agents can impair cognition. So they have done mouse studies where they take little mice, little animals, and they mirror... this is actually in traumatic brain injury research. So they mirror a traumatic brain injury in these little animals, and they give some of them antipsychotics, some of them they give nothing, some of them they give certain antipsychotics, the typicals versus the atypicals, and they see how long it takes the mouse to learn how to navigate a maze. And they know that those animals that are treated with the antipsychotics take longer to learn than the animals that are treated with nothing. So we know, at the very least from that, that the antipsychotics can impair brain healing after a traumatic brain injury. And we can surmise, although I'm not familiar with the literature, if there is research on this, that long-term use of neuroleptics may impair cognitive development, may impair cognitive growth. But there are huge numbers of children and adolescents running around out there who have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, who are on these medications for most of their lives. And what are we actually doing to those young brains as they develop? The answer is we don't know, but probably nothing good. We can at least say that.
Yeah.
So getting kids off of these medications, if possible, is really the direction we want to go in.
I have an adult friend, maybe more than one adult friend, who have been on SSRIs and had very negative reactions to them, experienced a kind of brain fog, if you will. And yet they seem to be... used so routinely, and I know because of my friends, I'm aware that there are discussion boards online where people are complaining about terrible reactions that they've had and that they can't seem to get off of them. What can you tell us about that whole ball of wax?
Sure. So, no, that's a great question. We do know that the SSRIs can sometimes disrupt the sleep architecture. So there are four stages of sleep that everybody goes through at night, four to five. And they happen in a certain sequence, a certain phase, and for a certain period of time. And SSRIs do mess that up. So for some people, they're not getting restful sleep on the SSRIs, and it's an individual response, and that can make you feel more foggy during the day. I've absolutely had patients that I treat with SSRIs who say, I'm just not sharp. I don't have that edge. I can't think clearly. I haven't had as many children and adolescents, and whether that's because they don't know their brains as well or whether that's because that effect is more seen in the adult population is difficult for me personally to suss out. In terms of having trouble getting off of them, even though I've said that these medications don't introduce a new chemical that changes the brain, it is a chemical, fundamentally, right? Or else we wouldn't have to take the pill. And there are side effects associated with that. There are GI side effects, which are actually an effect because they're serotonin in our GI tract as well as our brain. But there are sleep side effects. There are sexual side effects. There are all sorts of side effects. And there's a withdrawal. So certain medications are famous for that. Paroxetine is one. Venlafaxine is another. That getting off of them can be really difficult because people just feel yucky if they try to get off of them too quickly. That's not to indicate that you're addicted to these chemicals or that you'll never be off of them again, that you're dependent on them. But it can feel uncomfortable if you try to get off of them too quickly. For people who have that response, we'll sometimes go to a much, it may sound sort of counterintuitive, but will go to a much longer acting SSRI, something like fluoxetine, for example, that stays in the body for a week at a time, and then just sort of slowly taper that down to get them off of it. But in my experience, if somebody's on an SSRI and they don't like how they feel, if we stop the SSRI, they just go back to right how they were feeling before, that there aren't those sort of permanent changes, that permanent dependence that a lot of people seem to worry about. I everybody has individual responses to these chemicals, and you do have to pay attention to that and work with your psychiatrist. In my experience, for parents and children, I do tell them that the internet can be a dangerous place. And just because somebody else had a negative response doesn't mean that you yourself will have a negative response. But if you have a negative response, talk to your doctor about it. Talk about what you can change to make that different. And some people just say, you know what, these chemicals aren't for me. I want to see if I can get through this with dedicated psychotherapy, with frequent coming back. And all the evidence shows that psychotherapy and medication is the most effective treatment for depression out there. So if somebody is really nervous about these, really cautious about medications, I never push, unless I'm really worried about somebody, of course. But I always say, let's try psychotherapy first. Let's see if that can pull you out of your depression, can teach you the skills to keep you from recurring.
Yeah, in your book, I got the impression, because you have several chapters on medication, and then there follows a chapter on psychotherapy, I was wondering, does that mean that medications are the first line of intervention and are preferred over counseling/psychotherapy?
No, certainly not. We didn't mean to give that impression with the ordering of our chapters. That was certainly not our intent. To some extent, it depends on the severity. If you have somebody who's so clearly severely depressed and has been for so long that they get no joy from life, that they're almost in the anorectic scale because they've lost so much weight, that they really can't get out of bed, that they cannot function, that they're constantly thinking about ending their life, then sure, we try to get out the biggest gun we have to try to help them feel better. So we'd go to medications first. If we're convinced that it's a biological depression, we'll always have the discussion about medication because we do think that for that subset of depression, it's the most effective treatment. But I would say probably the majority of cases we see in the outpatient world are very responsive to psychotherapy as a first-line treatment. There are some conditions, such as obsessive-compulsive disorder, for which psychotherapy is the gold standard of treatment, and medications can augment that. But without exposure-response prevention, you won't get to where you need to be. I think we have patients who think both ways about it. We have some who come in and say, I don't want to take a pill. I don't want to introduce anything into my body. I want to try psychotherapy first. And that's fine. We say, even for the most severe, again, we don't want to push it. So we say, let's try it for 3 months. We'll see what sort of changes happen, and then we'll reintroduce the idea of psychotherapy. Of medication.
Yeah.
We also have people on the other side of the spectrum who say, I don't have time. I don't have an hour in my week to give to talk to somebody about how I'm feeling. I've tried psychotherapy in the past and it hasn't worked. They have all these preconceived notions about it. I don't want to come in and spill my heart out on the table. I'm not ready for that. Just give me a pill and fix it. And we say, if that's how you feel, we'll try it for a month. We'll try it for 2 months. But if it's not working, we should revisit the idea of psychotherapy. Because even for people who have a very clear biological depression, they're going along just fine in their life and their mood falls out from under them, that hurts, and that causes damage over a long period of time. If you isolate from your friends, if you terminate a relationship, if you fail your classes, that leaves collateral damage for your psychological processing and your self-attitude that medications don't fix. Mm-hmm. So there's always something that psychotherapy can help. And for a lot of cases, I think it could be the primary treatment, if not the only treatment.
Okay, well, I'm glad, as a psychologist, I'm glad that we've cleared that up. You have an enlightened attitude from my point of view. Now, you distinguish between antidepressant medications and mood-stabilizing medications. I wasn't aware of that distinction. What's the difference?
So the best mood-stabilizing medications are both antidepressant but also anti-manic. So they prevent both. They hold the mood in the middle. There are some mood stabilizing medications that really are anti-manic agents. Medications like Depakote They're not great for depression, but they're great for mania. They can bring somebody right back down. Lithium is probably the best example of a true antidepressant and a true anti-manic agent, the combination of which is really a mood stabilizer. Lithium has a number of other effects. It slows down cycles. You can give it to plants. You can give it to flowers and see their cycles slow down. It's really interesting research, actually. Antidepressants really just work on the one side of the spectrum. They're not happy pills. They don't force somebody's mood to be happier. But if your range of mood is constricted, if it's down, it'll allow the full range of mood. So somebody on an antidepressant, if they suffer a loss in their life, you know, somebody has depression, they're treated, they're on an SSRI, they felt great for years and years and years, and their family member dies, they're going to feel sad. We wouldn't want to take that away from them if we could. And the medications, for most people, won't prevent that. There are some people who feel sort of flattened out, which is usually either a medication response or a dose response, and we work with that because that's not the goal. It's just to feel nothing and to feel even. But for most people on antidepressant treatment, they'll feel sad if there's a reason to feel sad, but they can feel happy or they can feel normal if there's no reason to be sad. The mood stabilizers really, really do even out mood. They compress mood a little bit, both from the manic and ideally the depressive side.
Yeah. What comes to mind in this context is paradoxical reactions, because I was, a long time ago, I was prescribed Valium for, I think it was actually some GI issues that I was having, and they prescribed Valium. And unbeknownst to me, over time, I was becoming manic, more and more manic, not to the point, thankfully, of ruining my life, but I was well on the way. And so that kind of thing happens, I guess, right?
Yep, absolutely. And actually, those sorts of responses are more likely to happen in children and adolescents, especially with medications like the benzodiazepines, medications like the antihistamines, Benadryl. It's very common that kids will have paradoxical reactions to that. So we're much more cautious about those medications in young persons. But, you know, I've certainly had cases of both young people and adults who come in and say, this antidepressant made me feel more depressed. That's certainly not the goal. That's not what we're trying to achieve. But some people do have idiosyncratic responses to medicines, and we have to be careful about that. We warn everybody about those.
Yeah, good. You've got a chapter on alternative medications and treatments in which you cover such things as antipsychotic medications, which you've mentioned, benzodiazepines, St. John's wort, omega-3 fatty acids in fish oil, exercise, medical marijuana, electroconvulsive therapy, stimulation of the vagus nerve, and transcranial magnetic stimulation. So I'm not going to have you go through all of those, but maybe, that's an interesting chapter. And going back to the internet, often it's on the internet that you discover, oh, well, look, here's something I can try. I can hook my head up to a 9-volt battery. And so we do need to be cautious. Of those things that I mentioned, what looks most dangerous to you and what looks most promising?
Most dangerous certainly are the more invasive treatments, you know, things like electroconvulsive therapy. First of all, there's a whole stigma, sort of populist view about ECT and what that actually looks like. The truth is it's a very safe treatment, and we do use it for the most severe, the most refractory cases. And I've certainly seen cases where it is the only thing that has cured depression and really cured it. People have to have maintenance, of course, but it's the only thing to pull them out of their depression or pull them down from their mania.
Whoa, is there an earthquake there?
No earthquake. Little sleep. Okay. Everything's good. Thank you for asking. Things like TMS are supposed to be much safer. It works through magnetism to help. We don't exactly know how it works, but to help align the neuronal pathways in the brain. Seemingly safer, but you're still introducing something outside of the body, which is always worrisome. So I would say that although those tools are in our arsenal, and that's really what we wanted to introduce in that chapter, they're not for everyone. But they are available. I would say some of actually the safest and most effective treatments are some of the ones we discuss. Exercise, for example, has been shown in studies to be just as neuroprotective and just as effective as a low-dose antidepressant. Even though that's why that's why depression is so dangerous, is it makes us do everything that makes us feel worse. It sort of perpetuates itself. So people who are depressed, they don't want to get out of bed. They don't want to exercise. They don't want to go out in public. They don't want to talk to their friends. They don't want to do all the things that would actually help them. And exercise is a big component of that. In terms of nutrition, I'll be honest, I take a fish oil capsule every day just for general health. You know, there are studies saying that our consumption of omega-3 fatty acids is greatly decreased compared to our ancestors and how our bodies are set up. There have been studies on fish oil as an adjunctive treatment, and it seems to be very helpful when added to antidepressants, which I think we talk about in the book. And actually in Great Britain, St. John's wort is used as a treatment. You can get a prescription for St. John's wort to take it in for more mild cases of depression. So all of its risk benefit, you know, I think that those sort of lifestyle changes, nutritional changes are very effective first line, frankly, something that everybody should try to incorporate into their lifestyle if possible. Then we move on to things like medications for cases that are refractory, for cases that don't work. And then for even those cases that are really difficult to help, we wouldn't hesitate to use something like electroconvulsive therapy if it's truly life-saving. You know, people don't talk about this, but depression is a fatal illness. Something like 10 to 20% of patients with major depressive disorder will either attempt or commit suicide at some point in their life. So if it's really serious, if it's really refractory, you know, we wouldn't hold back from somebody who really needs that. Yeah. All of this, of course, that we've talked about is in conjunction with psychotherapy. I would say psychotherapy can be benign, can be hurtful, but in most cases doesn't have too many side effects, but can be just as effective as medication for some people, can be just as effective as the more invasive treatments for some people. So that's sort of on a parallel track.
Yeah, yeah. You've got a chapter on ADHD. And I'm wondering why. Is there a relationship between adolescent depression and ADHD, or do they look alike? What's the deal there?
No, that's a great question. So in a number of ways, ADHD can be related to it or mistaken for mood disorders, or vice versa. You know, to some extent, gets back to the symptom and syndrome that we had earlier. Some of the symptoms of depression can include inattention, difficulty completing homework, irritability, social isolation, difficulty sitting still, sort of a rambunctiousness, similar to mania. So a lot of children with pretty severe, pretty significant ADHD were put on neuroleptics, on antipsychotics, because they were diagnosed with bipolar affective disorder when really they had a severe ADHD. But they couldn't sit still. They were talking a mile a minute. They were very impulsive. They had to get up and walk around the table. They had severe sleep disturbance, which is pretty part and parcel with ADHD, so it's hard to tease apart what's actually going on underneath. I understand that the bread and butter cases of sort of simple ADHD and simple mood disorder do look very different, but I think the severe cases of both can cross over, and a lot of children who have experienced trauma in their life have symptoms of both. So we did want to try to tease that apart a little bit. Also because the medications used to treat ADHD, the stimulant medications, can make mania worse. So if somebody truly has a bipolar affective disorder, we're much more careful about treating the ADHD, especially with stimulants. And if we're worried about that in a young person, we'll tell the parents what to be on the lookout for if it does seem like they're ramping up. Also, just having ADHD can be difficult, right? Children can learn that they're on the outside of the class. They begin to learn that they can't sit still and focus. And sometimes they get reinforced by teachers and parents. Why can't you do this? What's wrong with you that you can't just sit and read a book? And so it's a severe ego hit that a lot of kids have to go through and have to live with. So sometimes just having ADHD can lead to symptoms of depression. And again, just medicine doesn't fix that. That's something that has to be worked out in psychotherapy once the ADHD is properly diagnosed and treated.
Okay, and similarly, you have a chapter on autism, Asperger's, and related disorders. And again, I'm wondering if you see a connection between those and adolescent depression.
There are a couple of reasons we wanted to put that chapter in. One is just the preponderance of diagnosis. The diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder has increased exponentially recently. Right. So we didn't want to ignore that. We wanted to talk about that. Another thing that we found interesting is even though children and adolescents with autism one of the hallmarks of autism is an interpersonal disconnect, a seeming discaring, which some people can see as unemotional, right? So you would assume that kids with autism or Asperger's, maybe they're protected. Maybe they're less likely to have depression because that's not as a relevant a part of their life. But actually, when we looked at the studies, they're much more likely to experience depression. And a lot of that does come out as irritability. And they have significant difficulty expressing their internal world, partially because they can't see it, and partially because they can't see it in other people. So why would they tell anybody about it? So I think they're much, if they do have depression, they're much more difficult to treat, both from a psychotherapeutic and a biological standpoint. They seem to be much more sensitive to medications for whatever reason. But also that they're more prone to the very thing that we would want to treat in them. So we thought it was worthwhile putting that in and talking about that.
Okay. And adolescent depression can lead to troubling forms of what might be called acting out, mm-hmm. Such as alcohol, drug abuse, eating disorders, cutting, other self-harming behaviors. Maybe you can walk us through these a bit and what parents can do in the face of such challenges.
Sure. So it's all of those conditions make treating depression much more difficult for various reasons. Kids start using it as a coping skill and start relying on it to help their depressive symptoms. So it becomes entrenched. And for a lot of young persons, it becomes a separate condition that you have to treat individually. So where I was trained, it's one way of thinking about patients. I was trained at Hopkins on what's called the perspectives. And those sorts of behavioral conditions, things that you actually do to yourself, such as cutting, such as eating disorders, such as substance abuse, they deserve a whole separate type of treatment. Again, medications don't fix that. You have to actually change your behavior and change what you're doing. So treating those children is much more difficult mm-hmm. than treating somebody with just a strict depression. And we actually warn children and adolescents about that, who, you know, start dabbling in cutting, who start dabbling in throwing up when they feel uncomfortable, or start drinking at parties because that's the only time they enjoy themselves. We tell them they're going down a very dangerous path, and this can very easily turn into a whole beast that they don't expect to have to deal with, totally separate from the depression that would have to be treated by itself. So I would encourage parents to think about it exactly that way, that even though one can cause the other, and they beget each other. So obviously, if you feel depressed, you feel angry, and you cut yourself, and that feeling goes away, sure, you feel better in the moment, but the next time you feel bad, you're going to be more likely to go to that sort of escape valve, that cutting, and it's going to be more difficult to fight when you're told you can't do that anymore, because you're always going to want that option. Mm-hmm. Same with substance abuse. So both because biologically substance use can lead to depression, but we tell kids and parents that's a very dangerous road to go down, again, for both parents and kids, just because someone was depressed and they're self-treating with alcohol and then you with a magic wand, take away the depression, that doesn't mean that the substance use or the cutting will disappear by itself. Sometimes you do have to address that separately, and that's how we like to think of it.
Okay. Another question I have relates to the genetic connection in depression. And in my own family, I have a grandfather who I believe was hospitalized for either manic bipolar, I guess that's the word I'm looking mm-hmm. for, and then his son, my biological father, went through a period of a short hospitalization for that. I've struggled with depression myself over the years. I have sons. And my sons, when they were teenagers, with one or two of them, I remember having some conversation and telling them that, hey, we have this history, mm-hmm. and so you need to be aware of that and try to distance yourself a little bit from feeling like it's your fault. It's just as if you had some kind of a medical issue, as you said mm-hmm. earlier, and you just have to kind of work around it. So aside from sharing that story with you, maybe there's some you can tell. I had the impression that maybe the heritability of it was stronger in the male line, that I recalled research to that, but that was research from long ago. I don't know if that's really true or not.
I'd have to refresh myself on that. That's not something I'm necessarily familiar okay. with, going through the male line. Uh-huh. I will say you sound like a fabulous father.
Thank you. Thank you.
We do recommend to all sorts of parents to look at that sort of a family history, just like they'd look at a family history of diabetes or immunodeficiencies or anything else that travels through the family, because there's a strong genetic line and heritability that goes along with these mood disorders. So having that sort of a discussion with your children when they're mature enough to understand it, that this is something to watch out for. It may or may not be something you have to work with. If it does happen, we do a lot of that. This is not your fault. We tell the parents, this is not your fault. You weren't a bad parent. This is just something that goes through the family.
Yeah.
There's nothing you could have done to prevent this. But
yeah.
Now we fortunately have the tools to address it and to treat it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't discover my own family history. I didn't know the history from that side of my family until much later in life, till I was in my 30s. But in a way, it was a bit of a relief to discover that, because it allowed me to let myself off the hook.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And we see that a lot in families here. I say here, families anywhere, that will be taking the family history, and the parents say, oh, no, there's no family history of anything. Everything's been perfect. No, we don't know why the son's acting this way. And then when we talk to the families themselves, they'll say, okay, don't tell him, but his aunt killed herself. And the uncle, we don't talk about the uncle. He's someone that the family takes care of and we just don't address. So there is that stigma that makes it really difficult to figure out what exactly is traveling through your family. And it's important to have a very open, honest discussion about that, because there's nothing shameful about it. There's nothing embarrassing about it. It's like being embarrassed that you have diabetes. It's something that happens. It's no one's fault.
Right.
And it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be known about.
Yeah. The final chapter of your book is titled Looking Ahead. So what do you see as you look ahead for the future of diagnosing and treating adolescent depression?
So one thing that I found really interesting in writing the second edition of this book, the first edition was written solely by Dr. Monimore in 2002, and then I updated it for the 2015 edition. I actually made very few changes to that last chapter, because even as far as we've gotten in psychiatry and psychology, in terms of figuring out more and more about what's going on, more advanced treatments, more knowledge about the genetic causes, we still have so far to go in terms of even catching up with the rest of medicines. And the great ideals that we were looking at then all hold true. We want to know more about the genetics. We want to be able to trace. We want to be able to do a genetic test and say, oh, you're at risk for this. Or do another genetic test and say, yes, you're depressed, and the perfect medication for you is fluoxetine based on the way you metabolize it. There are some genetic tests that propose to do that, to see how your liver metabolizes medications, but frankly, they're not that predictive of response. And even what they're supposed to predict, which is side effects, aren't always correct. So those ideas of more in-depth biological treatments, things like ketamine are being studied at UCLA. They seem to provide a more rapid relief, but they're certainly not ready for the mainstream, and we don't really even know how it works. So the sort of big ideals of better diagnosis, better treatment, better knowledge of where this all comes from, they all are the same. We're still looking at exactly the same things. So even as our knowledge is growing, there's still so much more we need to know.
Okay. And is there anything else that you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
I don't think so. I think we've done a great job of covering everything. Thank you so much. But if parents or children or anybody who's listening to this wants to get more information, the internet can be a little bit dangerous. So I would say we worked hard on this book. Look at this. But also the National Alliance of Mental Illness has a great website. The American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry has a whole section called Facts for Families on various of these conditions, which are written by the big thought leaders in the field. They're evidence-based. They're well put together. So, there are good places to get good information. So be careful about what you look at, but don't be shy about getting more information if you're worried about you or your family.
Okay, well, that's a good wrap-up, and I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
It's always been my practice to turn off the recorder at the end of the interview and to have a little closing off-mic chat with my guest. I think maybe I'll stop telling them the recorder is off, because often they become more candid and less self-conscious when the formal part of our conversation is over. And there have been a number of times when I regretted turning off the recorder because they went on to say something that made me really wish I had the recorder on. Today's interview is a case in point. As soon as I turned off the recorder, Dr. Kelly said something along the lines of, "I don't know if it would have been appropriate or not during the interview, so I didn't mention that I've been a long-time Shrink Wrap Radio listener." Of course, I had no idea until that point that he said that. I asked him how he discovered the show, and he let me know that he searched iTunes for psychology and psychiatry and found that Shrink Wrap Radio was one of the highest-ranked, if not the highest-ranked show for that category. He went on to say that he used to have a long commute to UCLA, and the show helped him get through the long drive. Also, he confided that most of his training was biological rather than about psychotherapy, and that Shrink Wrap Radio had really expanded his knowledge about various approaches, such as Jungian psychology and psychotherapy and others. Well, you can imagine my delight on hearing this, and I jokingly told him that no wonder he was such a knowledgeable guest and pro-psychotherapy. Here I had been molding him without even knowing it. I also am trying something new with this episode by recording part of it on video. My plan is to put a short video clip of the interview in my monthly newsletter and also on my YouTube series, in which for the past year or so, I've been providing a verbal preview of each podcast. So if you're curious to see what we look like during the interview, you might enjoy seeing the clip in the newsletter for February 2016 or on my YouTube for episode number 492. Searching YouTube for Shrink Wrap Radio should bring it up. I'd be curious to know if anybody likes these brief video clips, so I'll know if it's worth the additional work on my part to produce them. I strongly recommend Dr. Kelly's book for the general listener who is interested in learning more about depression, either for themselves or for friends and family, and also for therapists, especially for those who work with adolescents. As always, you're encouraged to order it using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar. The title, once again, is Adolescent Depression, A Guide for Parents by Mondemore and Kelly.
Dr. Dave, I'm continuously inspired and educated by your podcast. You interview such a wide variety of sophisticated and intelligent guests in such a graceful, well-orchestrated, and easy-to-listen-to way. I learn so much from listening while I make art and organize my life. I want to make sure this podcast keeps up and running and will be supporting more as I am able to in the future. I'm currently just finishing up my master's degree at Southwestern College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, studying art therapy and counseling. Just want to say thanks for the many gifts your work offers others and much appreciation. And I hope to, donate more in the future, and I encourage others to do the same. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Well, it's great to hear from another student who is informed and inspired by this podcast. And if she can afford to support this service as a student, perhaps you can too. We do have some new donors, and my sincere thanks go out to Ronald Sala, Paul Rockwood, Jane Morrow, and Dove Galodner. A week or so ago, I had the pleasure of being interviewed by a podcaster in Melbourne, Australia. The podcaster in question is Amy Fellman, and the title of her show is We All Wear It Differently. And it's a psychology podcast interview series that aims to inform, motivate, and inspire early career psychologists, of which she's one also. We had a delightful conversation. I think I was her 20th guest and her first international one. You'll find a link to her interview with me under the In the Media tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. If I can make my mileage points work for me, I think I'll be traveling to the Netherlands in June to attend the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference there. I'd love to see any of you there who can make it. Please take a look at the banner ad for the conference that I've put in the left-hand sidebar. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing three of the keynote presenters for that conference. So expect a new round of interviews on dreams and dreaming. Speaking of the left-hand sidebar, I've put two new Amazon ads there for you to click on and in the process add a little support for Shrink Wrap Radio. One of the ads features a new offer every day. So I can't tell you what it will be when this comes out, but I can tell you it will be a money-saving offer. The other Amazon ad is especially for students offering 40% off on textbooks and also textbook rental. Finally, let me draw your attention to our sponsor, Warby Parker. I'm sure from my previous mentions here that you understand that they are an online provider of stylish frames and lenses, and that you can have a free trial of 5 frames shipped to your home for free, along with free return shipping. The costs of frame and lenses start at $95. That's what most people end up spending. If you need multifocal lenses, those can be handled as well. You might recall my mentioning that two of my sons are very satisfied Warby Parker customers. I think the biggest appeal for both of them was not only the cost, but more importantly, style. Both are very style-conscious young men. I was surprised to learn, however, that they didn't get them online, but rather in brick-and-mortar stores. Matthew got his in Manhattan, and Jonathan got his in San Francisco. It turns out that they have stores in a number of cities in the U.S. and Canada. Of course, most of you will love the convenience of their online offering. But if you happen to live in a major city where they have a store, you might prefer that. Just click on the Warby Parker banner ad in our left-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com for full information and to get the purchase process started. And by doing so, you'll be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, this is Dr. Gabor Mate, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Gabor Mate, who was my guest on episode number 359, Addiction in the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. I'll read just one email from our listener community today. It's from Miroslav in the Ukraine, who writes, "Hello, with great pleasure to listen to all your programs. Thank you very much for your work, quality programs, and good mood. We would like to get something from you, souvenirs. Is it possible or not? Thank you very much for your attention. Have a nice day and prosperity. Your fan," and that's from Miroslav Kaban. Well, Miroslav, and I hope I'm not butchering your name too badly, I really appreciated hearing from you. I had no idea that I had even one listener in Ukraine, and I hope you'll tell your friends about it, and then I'll have more than one listener in the Ukraine. And I'm so happy to hear that you are listening and finding these to be quality programs and that you get a good mood from me. I was a little puzzled by your request for a souvenir and whether that was possible. And the best that I had to offer for a souvenir was to suggest that you subscribe to our newsletter and then you would get the free download of my talk on dreams. So great to hear from you. And I think with that, I'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that, and full details can be found under the Apps tab on our site. So thanks to today's guest, Patrick Kelly, MD, for his insights into adolescent depression and the treatment thereof. My next guest will be Nathan Ehrlich, freelance multimedia journalist, and we'll be discussing his shamanic healing journey in coping with a serious medical condition. Part of our session will be an audio documentary that he created for another podcast, and then I'll follow up with an interview with him. This format will be something entirely brand new, and so you should listen for that reason, if none other. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, It's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.